You're listening to The Fifth Estate from the Wheeler Centre. This week, Kevin Rudd joins us to talk about the coronavirus crisis and its impact on the world's economic and diplomatic order. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
And it's a real pleasure tonight to introduce our guest, Australia's 26th Prime Minister, former Foreign Minister, and since 2014, President of the Asia Society Policy Institute, which is based in New York. But Kevin Rudd joins us this evening on Australian shores. And Kevin Rudd, welcome. Welcome to the Wheeler Centre virtual hall. It's so great to see you.
Well, thanks, Sally, and I look forward to speaking with you and all the folks who happen to be tuning in from across Australia and in Victoria. So good to be with you.
Well, I was reflecting today actually on the 2020 summit, which of course was in 2008, and realising that, you know, in that weekend, all those incredible minds that were together, nobody could have foreseen that 2020 would look like this. I was also having another look at your memoirs, both volumes of them. They're big, big books. And I didn't recall reading anything that would have referred to a pandemic. And in your index, there's nothing between Palestine and Leon Panetta. And so I just wanted to start by asking, could you ever have imagined that 2020 might have shaped up the way that it has?
Well, in some respects, yes. In 2008, you just mentioned the 2020 summit, Sally. One of the recommendations from the Health Working Group, as I recall, and we had 10 working groups across that gathering of 1,000 people, it recommended the further development of Australia's national pandemic management strategy. As a result of that, in 2009, we, the Australian government then, conducted a nationwide pandemic planning exercise involving all the state governments. But I'm reliably informed that that was the last time there was a national planning exercise, that is like a war game or a desktop strategy session, where we played out the actual dynamics of managing a pandemic. So it may not have made it into the thoughts of Kevin, which you've just referred to, the books that I've just written. But it doesn't mean it was part and parcel of what we were seeking to do. And one final point on that, Sally, of course, is that in 2009, we had to deal with the eruption of H1N1 around the world. And that of itself informed a lot of the work that we did in that national, as it were, war game exercise of pandemic management back then.
You did, of course, steer Australia through a great crisis, the global financial crisis. So you do have a working memory of what it's like to be in government, to be the Prime Minister, and something really, really massive is taking place. What did you learn from that experience that you're perhaps seeing play out or not play out in leadership now?
Well, the truth is, when you have a global economic crisis of the type that we had in the GFC and previously had in the Great Depression, there are some things which are similar and there's some things which are, of course, unique. What's unique about the current crisis is the fact you have a double-barreled crisis, a public health crisis, and therefore an associated economic crisis because of the comprehensive lockdowns occurring in economies around the world. What we had a decade ago was a crisis which began in financial markets, which then translated through lightning rods across financial institutions throughout the world. And that catapulted into the real economy and produced mass unemployment. So the causalities are different. But you know something, in dealing with a crisis of this nature, you still go back to the same policy toolbox in many respects. Morrison spent his life ridiculing the idea that economic stimulus had any role Australian national life. He rejected it through the course of 2019, despite the weakening of the Australian economy then. And I know from my friends and colleagues in the bureaucracy in Canberra that he was dragged kicking and screaming to a final realization that he'd have to take on stimulus if we weren't going to allow this country to slide into depression. And so I think they were tardy in coming to those decisions on the economy. And frankly, on top of that, they didn't get the sequencing right. They announced the lockdown before they announced the national wage guarantee. And as a result, hundreds of thousands of people were thrown into unemployment.
What about the scale of the help when it came, though? Is that not a, a commendable outreach given the problem that was in front of them?
Well, if you're prepared to forgive the rank hypocrisy of a government which for 10 years has campaigned against economic stimulus and debt and deficit to meet a global crisis, does it ring any bells? That's kind of what we did back then.
It's also what leadership's about, though, isn't it, that you would even throw out your deepest held beliefs with a crisis in front of you. Is that not to be commended?
Well, Mr. Morrison, I think, runs around the place talking about the death of ideology. That's code language for we, the Liberal Party, got it wrong for 10 years. We've campaigned against the role of government as a central driver of economic activity, most particularly in times of economic crisis. So we have some deep learnings as a nation to go through as a result of this crisis. There can be a technical debate about the scale and sequencing of the current stimulus strategy. But underneath it all is a deep question of government ideology. And for decades, the Conservatives in this country have campaigned on around the thesis that government is bad, shrink the state, cut taxes, and as a result, liberate the private sector. Well, that's fine, except in the last financial crisis, and you may recall the essay I wrote for the monthly magazine back then.
I certainly do.
on the global financial crisis and its impact on liberal capitalism, is that the private sector then cried out for help from government to step in and save the institutions, save people's bank deposits and save the economy and employment, which we did. So that was an attestation of a continuing Keynesian truth from the 1930s. These guys have opportunistically campaigned against that now for decades. So if there is a real death of ideology, it must rest on a core proposition here that the Conservatives have campaigned on an absolute falsehood for the previous decade, and this represents a complete volte-face. Of course, all that now seems normal in Australian politics because the medium for expounding and explaining on that to the Australian public is left in the hands of the Murdoch media, which behaves as a political coalition partner of the Liberal and National Party, not an independent news mechanism.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see how long this change of heart economically lasts with the government at the moment. On the health front, though, I mean, I think the whole world is looking at Australia and, of course, New Zealand, who are back to hugging each other today, but Australia as well, that we've done a really, really good job and made real use of our asset. We've turned the tyranny of distance has become a great blessing, and our population size and so on. What have you made of the health response, and in particular the fascinating work between the federal government and the states, the likes of which we have never seen, this kind of a national cabinet, I think ever. I know we've had them in the past in wartime and so on, but not working like this, not with states asserting their power in a way that we've just never seen.
The unsung national heroes out of this entire COVID-19 crisis and the public health policy responses have been the state governments of Australia. And I say that not just rhetorically, as if I'm somehow distancing myself from Morrison, but because the states control hospitals and the health system, the states control schools and the education system, and the states control law enforcement. And as a result, on these core decisions, the states have acted, frankly, whether they are Liberal or Labor states, effectively, because they understand the nuts and bolts nature of this machinery of government. The feds, I think when the full history is written, again had to be dragged kicking and screaming to this. Why? If you recall the debates in March involving Dr. Norman Swan, Bill Botel, the critique emerging of Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand for having gone too hard, too fast, closing New Zealand's borders to Australia, etc. There was a period there when, if the history is written, Morrison's language publicly floated with doctrines of, let's call it, herd immunity. And as a result of that, there was an equivocal period where the country did not know which direction national health strategy would go. Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, actually, I think, leveraged Australia into closing borders and leveraged Australia into lockdown, because she adopted a decisive policy position, which was to eradicate the virus from New Zealand and to lock the country down. We then followed. The implementation of that then, frankly, fell to the hands of the states. And if any national prime minister at a time like that, worth his or her salt, would have then convened the states in whatever form, COAG or the national cabinet, as a rolling machinery of government. And I think you're right to say that's worked relatively effectively.
I'm talking to you from Melbourne, and so the Premier here in Victoria, Dan Andrews, the distinctive thing about the federal-state relationship in this that I will always remember is the tug of war over schools and the real assertion of Dan Andrews that, you know, the schools here would close against the Prime Minister's very strong wishes. When a relationship like this has been built very quickly in a crisis, and I think, you know, that your kitchen cabinet that was, you know, the four of you with the global financial crisis, I think now there's a national cabinet here. One of the difficulties is to unravel that when the crisis abates. And I always thought that was a challenge for your government when you've been in the height of that crisis and you've had to put your trust in sort of intensified way. The states, I can imagine a situation where they're not going to give up that kind of, the fight that they've been able to put up. Do you think this will change the sort of balance of relations in our federation at all in the long run, or will it go back to the way it was pretty quickly?
Well, in fairness to our period in government, you may recall that I said we would turn COAG into the workhorse of the federation. And contrary to the period prior to us being in office and the period after us being in office, we met COAG every 3 months. And we had a rolling agenda of national reform in health and education, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and a whole bunch of other areas, including National Indigenous Policy, etc. So there were many things that were achieved in that particular period, not least of which was the National Health and Hospitals Agreement of 2010, which remains in force as the underpinning funding agreement between Canberra and the states. We achieved those collaboratively. So the fact that Morrison has a national cabinet at a time of crisis, in my judgment, is no remarkable thing. The normal thing will be to continue that collaborative framework as we had it in the period in which I was Prime Minister, to again turn it into the workhorse of the Federation. Now, it only works if the feds, long-term, choose to be effective funding and functional partners with the states. We engineered an entire revolution in our national policy agreements between the Commonwealth and the states, which loosened up the level of intrusive federal oversight of state funding, so long as the states could demonstrate that they were achieving agreed national outcomes. That, I think, is the way to the future. But if instead we see Morrison shortchanging the states and cutting back on their financial assistance grants, which is the lifeblood of the state's ability to function, And if we see them adopting a more adversarial position on industrial relations, for example, or they allow the economy and employment to fall off a cliff by simply bringing stimulus payments to an abrupt end as opposed to tailoring them out, then I think you will start to see divisions legitimately reemerge.
Kevin, let's move abroad now and to the matters that probably occupy more of your thinking at the moment. And let's start with China, which of course is where this began, and your impressions of the conduct of the Chinese throughout this crisis.
As I've written in a number of places, Sally, the Chinese management of the crisis initially was very poor. We had, number one, a failure on China's part to implement its deep national learnings from the SARS crisis of 2003, including the real closure of wet markets across the country, that is, live animal markets. And despite China passing laws to that effect in recent years, they were never given proper effect. And so, therefore, the breeding grounds for these sorts of zoonotic viruses remained intact. Number two, the early notification system between the provinces and the national government in China failed. And there's been a huge and as yet unresolved, frankly, political and bureaucratic battle within China to establish precisely who covered up and for how long and why between the provincial health authorities, the central health authorities, etc. So that was a failure, particularly in those first critical 2 or 3 weeks of the disease outbreak, where time was lost. And the third, I think, genuine question mark is the extent to which China properly notified the World Health Organization and the extent to which the World Health Organization properly notified the world. These things we still don't have definitive answers to. In terms of China's subsequent management of the virus once it enveloped their country and their economy, then, of course, the full force of China's authoritarian state was brutally brought to bear. And as a consequence, within the matter of a couple of months, it was brought relatively under control. But that doesn't mean that there is a lingering concern about second wave effect, and that's real. Nor does it mean that there is that China has escaped massive economic consequences, which it hasn't. Unemployment's been hit. College kids have been told to stay on for graduate school because there are no jobs. And in the Chinese services industries, people just haven't got back to normal, just like they haven't got back to normal here.
Mm. What about Chinese cooperation with the rest of the world now in terms of what they know of this illness and transparency? I mean, when you read the figures that come out of China, when you read the information, when I read them, what should I believe?
Well, China has a notorious history in rubbery statistics. It goes back probably to the Great Leap Forward in 1959, when local officials just manufactured economic data in order to please Chairman Mao, that in fact his absolutely mad economic experiment of rapid industrialization and agricultural transformation was succeeding, when in fact it produced a famine which arguably killed 30 million people. So there's a bit of an industry here, particularly and made possible through China's, one-party state. But you know something, at the end of the day, the social media explosion in China, even within their closed internet system, Weibo and the other online platforms, China's equivalent of Twitter, it's difficult for the authorities to close the system down when there's a massive eruption of disease. And we saw that in January and February when the Chinese social media universe exploded. And exploded so much the Chinese system didn't have an algorithm to control it, within a given day. So my ultimate argument is that we haven't yet seen a massive, second wave effect, which has been undisclosed to the international public, because we'd know about it through Chinese social media. even if briefly, before things are shut down. But when things are held, are put up briefly in social media, as you know, they are screenshot, screen saved, and the news gets out. So I think we should have some confidence in the fact that we haven't seen a second wave effect. I have less confidence in the actual numbers that have been put forward publicly for the numbers of deaths and infections and those still suffering as a consequence from the first wave effect in China itself.
It seemed to me in the first few weeks or perhaps month or so of this pandemic, well, in fact, before it was declared a pandemic, that this COVID-19 was the first, in a way, the first real block to China's, you know, great assertion of its power that we've been seeing going on for so long, that finally it was confronted with something that had really got out of control. And I wondered that until, of course, the American response came. And since that time, I've wondered who's lost more in terms of their standing in the world, and how has this astonishingly tragic response in America for the more than 100,000 people that have died. How has this changed the balance of that relationship, and therefore everybody else in the world who, one way or another, is affected by both of these great powers?
Sally, if those tuning into this webinar, seminar, discussion are interested in this, I did a piece recently for the American journal called Foreign Affairs. Those who are watching this who are interested in an analysis of this at some depth.
Piece.
It's on www.kevinrudd.com website. So that goes to these questions in some detail. But what's the summary? Response to your very important question here. One is, I argue in that piece, and it's my analytical view, that both these great powers will emerge damaged from the COVID-19 crisis. Damaged objectively in terms of their economy, in terms of lost production of a massive order. China, on most recent projections from the IMF, looking at a growth of perhaps 1% in calendar year 2020, something which we haven't seen since the Cultural Revolution. The Americans taking a huge hit to growth and recession fully underway. You've seen the unemployment numbers in the United States. But beyond the economic damage, both countries have suffered reputational damage. And the reputational damage is acute. The reputational damage for China is, how the hell did your system allow this to mutate from being a local breakout to becoming a national crisis and a global crisis? It was your responsibility. And however China's new generation of wolf warrior diplomats may wish to, what's the word I'm looking for, spin this in the international community, the truth is developed and developing countries around the world are now not just scratching their heads, but are upset and angry about what happened with the arrival of this virus, which has destroyed livelihoods and cost millions of people their lives around the world, or hundreds of thousands of people their lives around the world, millions being infected. And so for the United States, when we have a global crisis like this, Sally, the rest of us have a reflex reaction. That is for Uncle Sam to exercise global leadership and pull states together in terms of both the global public health response and the global economic response. Well, this time Uncle Sam was missing in action, MIA. And that's because we saw the first clear evidence to the world of Trump and his doctrine of America First applied in practice, which was we in Washington don't give a rat's about the rest of you. And this vacuum in global leadership was just spectacular. and America's subsequent decision to pull out effectively both budgetarily and in terms of legal representation for the World Health Organization, as they're doing with the WHO, as they're doing with the Human Rights Council in Geneva, frankly just creates a global vacuum, which our Chinese friends have sought to step into. Mm. So where does that leave the rest of us? I think it leaves us with a global balance of power, which is now in a state of stasis between a damaged America and a damaged China. And I think the responsibility for the rest of us, what I call a coalition of the policy willing, or what I've also called, maybe the magnificent multilateral seven, countries like Germany and France, the European Union, maybe Boris's Britain, if they can decide whether they're Arthur or Martha on these questions, Canada, the Japanese, Singapore, Australia, if it was under a government which actually believed in the multilateral order, although this government has consistently sought to repudiate it and to malign it. Those states, in my judgment, my argument, have a responsibility to put the international system into a state of triage, fund it, support it diplomatically and politically, to ensure that at a minimum level, the institutions of global governance continue to function until we have a re-establishment of some great power equilibrium between the Chinese and the Americans.
It's a bit of a sad picture you're painting there, Kevin, and not least because of the countries that you didn't include then. India missing, obviously Russia is missing, that the either great or once great or potentially great nations. That you're looking to these European countries that have been devastated in a climate where even before COVID-19 there was a rising authoritarianism. Would we expect to see more of that now that there's that vacuum in leadership, or perhaps could there be a softening of it and people might look more towards the values of democracy and perhaps even social democracy in their futures?
Well, one concluding thought about India, given that you raised it, Sally. I would hope that India would be part of such a global coalition. It's a democracy. It's internationally active. Morrison has just had his virtual summit with Modi. But my observation of the Indian government's policy and strategy in the past has often been that the Indian national interest assumes primacy. India deliberately torpedoed the Doha round of free trade liberalisation as a matter of national interest for itself. And I hope that that posture is changing under the current Indian government. And if it is, then I would hope that they would form part of such a global coalition. But the characteristics which I've sought to describe with those other, shall I say, creative middle powers around the world are those which see an intrinsic public good in sustaining and strengthening the global rules-based order as a policy objective in itself, as opposed to simply a view of how do I use the global system to help me at a particular time on a particular issue. I'm not being blind about national self-interest. It exists, and I have argued national interest myself for Australia with great passion. But what I'm arguing for primarily is for these countries to see the institutions of global order as being a global public good in its own right, because order is relatively rare in international relations history. The history of international relations is primarily disorder and chaos. Mm. Briefly on authoritarianism and liberal democracy and social democracy, I think there's a lot of misreporting of the triumphs of the authoritarian systems. I interviewed just the other day Fareed Zakaria from the United States, CNN program host, but a public intellectual in his own right, on this question. And if we go through the list, authoritarian states have performed differently. If you look at what's happened in China, it's a mixed record for what we just said. You look at Vietnam, it's been almost a perfect score. No deaths, very few infections. And these are not simply manufactured statistics. There's some international corroboration of that. go to other authoritarian systems like Russia, it's been severely affected by the crisis. You go to the democracies, America has been, how do I put it delicately and politely, suboptimal. But you go to Asian democracies like South Korea and Taiwan, there's been a phenomenal performance. And look at New Zealand, it's a functioning democracy as well, and of course Australia. And so therefore there is no clean report card from this. What I think is essential and goes to the tail of your question on social democracy is, if we look at the eruption of race-related violence in the United States, the Black Lives Matters movement, this is not just a cry from the heart about racism, which it is, and now that I've lived in America for a number of years, it's real. But on top of that, it's a cry from the heart about inequality. Mm. And why social democracy now has a central role to play, frankly, in the revitalization of the democratic project, is that people's experience of inequality has been sharpened enormously as a consequence of the COVID-19 crisis. As someone said to me the other day, it's not an equal opportunity employer, the COVID-19 crisis. It disproportionately hits minorities and the poor.
Let's come back to the institutions that have also been trashed by Trump, as America has vacated that field of leadership. What's your impression of, I mean, the United Nations has seemed strangely absent to me, Kevin, perhaps missing your direct input, many Australians might feel, but how has it performed and the World Health Organization, how have those institutions stood up, do you think, without the backing of America? I mean, you imagine any other leader in post-war history of the United States, a crisis like this, there would have been an American president working with the United Nations, you'd imagine, with the WHO in one way or another. What's it meant for those institutions to not have that?
I think that's a critical factor. See, we're often in danger of judging whether the United Nations system or the multilateral system more broadly has been effective or not, based on what we read in the newspapers or see through mainstream television or sometimes in social media. Most of what the UN system does is largely invisible to the international community. If they are solving problems in the world by keeping people alive, for example, in Cox's Bazar at the moment, on the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar in terms of the displaced Rohingya, it's not going to make much news at present. Mm. But you know something? That work goes on. And so I can point to multiple theatres around the world. I think my second point, Sally, is simply this, that if we look across the world right now, this is a unique time in post-45 history. No US president has launched such a focused attack on the UN multilateral system as Donald Trump. Donald Trump has also attacked traditional U.S. allies and traditional alliance structures as well. Look at his threats against the Federal Republic of Germany most recently. But the bottom line is the attack on the UN multilateral system is kind of without precedent. That is, both Republican and Democrat administrations in the period since 45 have seen it as core business for America to support the institutions. It doesn't mean that the U.S. government at any particular time has always accepted the determinations of the Security Council. Look at the invasion of Iraq as a terrible example of the Bush administration's treatment. But by and large, the funding support, the diplomatic support, the political support for the machinery of the system, World Health Organization and the rest, has been a relative constant. So we are in unique times when America is walking away in financial terms. And as I said before, walked away from the WHO, walked away from the Human Rights Council, walking away from the World Trade Organization, has abandoned the UN Security Council's resolution, bringing about what's called the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And now we look at the prospect of Trump abandoning the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I mean, this is unprecedented. So anyone who's Secretary General of the United Nations right now would be having a hard time dealing with, shall I say, the new rogue state, which actually is in Washington. I use that poetically rather than physically in case I get into all sorts of trouble as a result of that. But what I mean is this is just unprecedented behaviour.
Well, it is. And, I mean, my next question is about at what point in diplomacy between nation states does the language of diplomacy have to change? And, you know, there was a really interesting silent response from Justin Trudeau a couple of days ago. It was quite brilliant, I thought, and it didn't give anyone a quote at all. And I mean, I have, with increasing horror, I mean, if I hear anyone from the Australian government talk about, you know, our friends in the Trump administration or my friend Donald Trump, I feel ill when I hear that. I understand that there are rules and traditions, and I remember arguing about this at length, particularly with Michael Fullilove from the Lowy Institute, well before coronavirus, when Scott Morrison was going off to the White House for the state dinner. And even back then I said, why do we have to accept such hospitality? Why can't we politely decline and still continue this great tradition of being allies? At what point in diplomacy can a country like Australia perhaps say something by perhaps a silence or some other? For how long do we have to be going through this absurd farce of pretending that Donald Trump and his administration is somehow a friend of ours?
Well, the really critical challenge here, Sally, is to differentiate between the Trump administration on the one hand, and let's call it the historical US alliance post-41, really, going back to the days of John Curtin, the darkest days of the Second World War. On the Trump administration itself, I mean, you're right. Look, for example, at Trump's torpedoing of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a core element of Australian government policy, and thereby undermining our own growth prospects in the Asia-Pacific region and, frankly, our ability to prosecute effectively our own economic agenda in the wider region. Number two, the bilateral trade deal with China, a mandatory U.S. purchasing order, Chinese purchasing order of $200 billion worth of American energy, agriculture and other products. Well, guess who becomes the fall guy for that? The Australian farmer and the Australian, mining industry. So there's a direct hit there. And so, yes, if you put the list together, it's a formidable one in terms of the direct damage to Australia's national interests. In diplomacy, there are kind of two schools, not two schools, but two approaches which can be conducted simultaneously. One is operational and the other is declaratory. Operationally, it depends on what you do, either in concert with or not in concert with the U.S. administration. And operationally, given America is an ally, but if this administration wants us to do things which are alien to our interests, then operationally we should be declining, though not necessarily making a declaratory song and dance about it, if you know what I mean. Mm. But there do come points in terms of declaratory language where it's important to make plain a position. And because I run an American think tank, I don't go out of my way every day to attack the Trump administration. We're a bipartisan institution. But frankly, just as a human being, but also, perish the thought, as a practicing garden variety Christian, but also as someone who is in the United States most of the time, when I saw the president's actions in front of the Episcopalian Church in Washington, just behind the White House there, St. John's, and the violence deployed to clear protesters away so that he could perform a media stump holding up the Bible, I felt I had no alternative but to speak, and I did very directly and forcefully, and I'm sure it's not about to get me a renewed invitation to the White House, where, in fact, I was in January attending the signing, would you believe, of the U.S.-China trade deal. But it's at times like that where you actually because of deeper values at stake, you need to part company. I think the posture of Australian government ministers at that time was deafening by its, shall I say, non-Trudeau-like silence.
You obviously are based in the States, in New York City, but you travel around a bit, I'd imagine. Was there a feeling up until the point, when did you actually leave? When did you come back to be in Australia with the coronavirus, Kevin? When did you decide to come back here?
Well, Therese and I are in and out of New York quite a bit, and I'm based there a lot of the time. So after the usual summer break here, I went back to New York to work in mid-January. And then I was there through until mid-March. And by that stage, having observed closely what was happening in China, I wrote an article and had it published, I think, in late February, which said, China's January and February will be the rest of the world's March and April. Mm. Of course, no one believed me because people in that stage just thought it was a, quote, Chinese or Asian thing in the kind of latter-day racism that we often see applied to these questions around the world. But I had a responsibility, because I run a think tank, to get my staff working from home, off the New York subway, safe and secure. I achieved that by about 15 March, and Therese sent me a very polite message saying, you get your ass home here. Mm. So I caught a Qantas flight home. So I've been back in Australia really since mid-March.
And with what you've seen so far of the Trump administration's response, what might be expected, if he were to lose the election in November, or to win? I mean, either way, it's almost impossible to imagine him taking a loss as legitimate. Would you agree with that?
One of the great geopolitical risks for 2020, and we've seen a few this year already, and we're only up to June, is if there is a close-ish American election outcome, given all the complications with COVID-19, all the complications with what's called absentee ballots in America, that's postal ballots, because they normally use the machine, or with unusual occurrences in the electoral process, quite apart from Republican efforts to suppress voter turnout on the part of a number of minorities in particular. If we end up with a narrow Democrat win by a couple of percentage points in early November, then the real danger is that Trump refuses to move and lodges a challenge of the result in the Supreme Court. Of course, that happened in 2000 in Bush versus Gore. Gore acted magnanimously, despite the fact that there is a serious view that it was simply the conservative majority of the court which awarded it to Bush as opposed to Gore, given the peculiarities of the Florida ballot.
The pregnant chads, wasn't it?
Yeah, the hanging chads, etc. Mm. So therefore, that is a real geopolitical risk. And in the United States, there is a minor industry emerging as to how to deal with this as a real living reality, something which we would find inconceivable in Australia, where whoever wins an election, by and large, has sufficient grace to call time on the other person. The other person usually has the grace to go, either happily or unhappily. Finally, I think, as we draw our conversation to a close this evening, I think in terms of the United States, if Trump's re-elected, for America's global leadership, this is very much, as I've written elsewhere, the last chance saloon. If Trump's re-elected, I think so many allies around the world are going to deeply reappraise how they manage their futures, given the unpredictability and, shall I say, the lack of alliance solidarity, let alone multilateral commitment of his administration, which, unconstrained by a re-elect in 4 years' time, could behave in a particularly curious fashion. Mm. Now, if the Democrats win, whatever people's critique of Joe Biden may be, I know enough about the system in the United States to know that he has the intelligence to assemble around him a first-class team, economic team, foreign policy team, national security team, international economic policy team. And so the ability, therefore, for a highly intelligent and well-experienced administration under Biden to, as it were, turn the great ship of American state around should not be, as it were, ignored. I think they're capable of that. But this is a fundamentally important election like no other, probably since the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932 to deal with the Great Depression.
Tell me what you're reading, Kevin.
What am I reading at present? This is kind of self-revelation time. Two sets of things. Both are a bit nerdy, but you asked, and I'm trying to give you an honest answer. I'm reading for my own research on an Oxford research project at the moment, the writings of Xi Jinping to work out how much of a Marxist he is.
That's pretty nerdy.
But I'm doing a dissertation, would you believe it, on Xi Jinping's worldview at Jesus College, Oxford. So I'm kind of working on that. What am I reading in terms of fun? I just finished volume 3 of Hilary Mantel, All About Tudors, kind of interesting. A bit of an insight into Trump's White House, I think.
As good as the first two volumes?
I haven't read properly the first
two.
But I have a deep interest in Thomas Cromwell.
Yes.
And the other thing I've been seeking to work on, read my way through, would you believe, having watched a movie about Carl Jung the other night, is Jung's own autobiography. So there you go. There's an eclectic mix.
And did you say you're doing a dissertation? You're doing a
D-Phil.
Yeah, right.
I've been doing it for about 2.5 years. I've got about a year to go.
Right.
I have very tolerant supervisors.
Well, you'll be better qualified for whatever you want to attempt in the future, Kevin. I'm pleased to hear it. It's been absolute joy to see you. Thank you so much for your wisdom and experience. And anybody that's listened tonight, of course, you've given a reading list of your own for the audience to enjoy. This conversation will be up as a podcast tomorrow. Kevin Rudd, stay well, and your family, and all the best, and thank you so much. And when you're in Melbourne, please come and see us in person here at the Wheeler Centre. We'd really, really love that. And to our audience listening tonight, gosh, we miss you. Those of you in Melbourne who are regular Fit the Staters at the Wheeler Centre, you are so, so missed, but thank you for tuning in this way. And for those of you that aren't, that are listening from elsewhere, thank you so much. Check out the website at the Wheeler Centre often, and we'll see you again soon. Have a wonderful evening, everybody.
Kevin Rudd speaking with Sally Warhaft for the Fifth Estate. This conversation was recorded on Tuesday the 9th of June 2020 and streamed live at wheelercentre.com. If you'd like to support our digital events, videos and podcasts, head to wheelercentre.com/donate and shout us a coffee or more. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, take care.